With the holiday season looming, it's time to consolidate the achievements of the past year and look ahead to the work yet to be done in the coming months, and for an in-depth look at the advances and shortfalls in the Indigenous affairs sector, we couldn't go past Auntie Pat Turner. Auntie Pat is the CEO of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation and is widely recognised and admired as one of the country's most senior civil administrators for Indigenous affairs policy. Auntie Pat, welcome back to Speaking Out.
Thank you very much, Larissa. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's become a bit of an annual tradition that we have you in towards the end of the year to give a bit of a year in review. And I know you've been involved in a lot of things, so thanks for coming in to help us unpack some of those.
My pleasure.
Well, this past week has been notable on a couple of fronts, but perhaps the most distressing has been yet another death in custody of a 19-year-old man from the community of Yuendumu in Central Australia. You're a Territory girl yourself, Auntie Pat. There have been questions around the circumstances of the death of Kumanjay Walker, which led to community protests around the country. Auntie Pat, with your finger on the pulse, what have you been hearing on the ground from communities in Central Australia?
Well, they've had a few get-togethers to protest outside the police station in Alice Springs. The community itself has had an ongoing vigil and demonstrations at Yuendumu. And, of course, supporters right around the country have been protesting about this particular incident. Very sad, very unfortunate, and a lot of questions need to be answered. First of all, I think sending the team in to the house instead of working through the community elders and the family to bring the young man in voluntarily to the police station, because he was out on release and he needed to go back into custody. So I just think that there were much better ways of handling it, which were not utilised by the police. So it resulted in the death of a 19-year-old man, which is not acceptable in Australia in this day and age. Of most concern to me is that there was no health service staff in Yuendumu at the time of this incident. So once the man was shot, he was taken to the police station. I would imagine that the police training is in first aid is fairly rudimentary, and hardly able to match that of a fully trained doctor, nurse, health workers who deal with these situations more, well, not shootings, but deal with serious injuries more in their line of work than the police in terms of rendering medical assistance. So it took over well over an hour for the ambulance to come from Yuendumu, a nearby community, because there were no health staff left in Yuendumu. They'd been evacuated apparently because of break-ins. But I asked the question, you know, well, what is the duty of care of the Northern Territory Department of Health in the provision of health services? And I'm a bit over hearing about staff having to be evacuated because of a break-in. I want serious answers given to what was the nature of the break-in, how serious was, were lives threatened? Was it absolutely necessary to evacuate all the staff? I think those questions have to be answered, because every community deserves ready access to primary health care, and that was obviously not available to the citizens of Yuendumu. The Walpiri people are very strong, but they're also very saddened and grieving deeply for the loss of this young man, and they want justice done. There will be an independent inquiry by ICAC in the Northern Territory and, of course, the coroner inquest. The community have asked, as I understand it, for that to be done quickly, not take the usual 12 months, but to make sure a thorough and proper investigation by the coroner is undertaken. What it raises, though, is the recruitment practices of the Northern Territory Police and the actual training, which is obviously inadequate in terms of people working in remote areas where English is not a first language and very strong traditional lifestyles are adhered to. I say that this young man had apparently had served in Afghanistan. I don't know whether he suffered from the usual trauma that our soldiers unfortunately have to contend with, and whether he had any of that post-traumatic stress as a result of his serving in Afghanistan. But if he did, he's certainly not the right sort of person to be sending out to work in Aboriginal communities. And I think that's a big question that needs to be answered by the Commissioner for Police in the Northern Territory. And I don't think that they should be recruiting soldiers who've had that post-traumatic stress and maybe still suffering from it, because it's not something that can be dealt with immediately. It's something that takes a long time of very professional treatment to enable our returned veterans to be able to resume a normal life. So that's the first area that I point to. The second area is the Aboriginal police staff that are recruited in the Northern Territory. I think it's high time that their cultural knowledge, language skills, and ability to communicate with people in their own languages has long been undervalued in the Northern Territory Police. I think those skills are more important than some of the whatever skills the outsiders bring to the Northern Territory. People who are not Aboriginal, who don't understand the communities. And I think that our Aboriginal police need to be on the same ranking as the other police recruits and have access to the same career paths within the police force in the Northern Territory, and that's not happening. To the best of my knowledge, there have been a few recruits, and those who have been recruited have done very well and try to do the best to look after our people and ensure their safety as much as anybody else's. For a young man to be shot dead in front of family is just totally and absolutely unacceptable. I believe that there are still unimplemented recommendations from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and really every jurisdiction needs to revisit that and really get on with the job. There are far too many deaths in custody. This was a death in the young man's family home, so it's just as bad as any death in custody. And I hope that the families get justice out of this.
I'm sure we'll all be watching developments in the case over the coming weeks. Another big story this week, Aunty Pat, centred around the recently announced senior advisory group to guide the co-design of an Indigenous voice to Parliament. And not surprisingly, you're involved in that group. You've had experience being the CEO of ATSIC, as well as being highly involved with the community-controlled sector. What elements do you consider imperative to a final model?
Well, I think that there's been a lot talked about in terms of a voice to Parliament, and, you know, the government has changed that priority to a voice to government. And I think it's important that all of our people make known their views in relation to this. It'll more likely, under this current government, be a legislated process, which is what our people don't want, because they've seen the demise of former federal bodies established for our benefit and then abolished. And there's been a long history of that in Australia, which is precisely why people wanted some sort of head of power in the constitution to enable our people to work directly with the Australian Parliament on all matters impacting on our affairs and our communities and our people. Nevertheless, this government has ruled out constitutional enshrinement. The Labor Party hasn't. There was a first meeting of the Senior Advisory Committee, and it's really just a very initial meeting to understand that there will be subcommittees or other committees that are under the Senior Advisory Committee looking at what the regional structures should be and what the national structure should be and how they should be brought into effect, I guess. The advice is to government, but I think we need to have a very open and transparent process and keep people posted on progress and enable people to have a real say, because there's been a long history of reports done on constitutional recognition and how you enable an engagement of First People to give effect to full self-determination, but to enable a proper partnership with the Australian Parliament. So I think it's a first step to get arrangements in place. I think nothing is off the table. Not as far as I'm concerned, nothing's off the table. I think that regional authorities, building on the powers of the regional councils, are the way to go. But, you know, let's hear from what our people want. And but they have to have autonomy. They have to have their own community development funding with less red tape and more ability for decisions to be made by elected representatives from our own groups across the country.
When you were CEO of ATSIC, you obviously oversaw a structure that had a regional layer as a very important critical level of that.
Yes.
And it seems to be that that conversation about regional governance remains consistent. From your perspective, with all of your experience, why is that the level that communities seem to always gravitate to when we have these questions about representation, leadership and participation?
Well, I think it's driven culturally. So you can get a cultural alliance in a region where they've always had migration and trading and ceremonies and whatever. Ceremonies go a lot further than just a region, of course. They go across the country. But, you know, there's lots of things that bind people at a regional level. A lot of communities are far too small for local representation and there's safety and strength in numbers. So I think our people are very pragmatic about that. And they realise the role of the state and territory governments becoming increasingly more important in service delivery. So, you know, they want to be able to work on a basis where they can interact with all levels of government. Regional arrangements allow that to happen more smoothly, I believe. So I think people underestimate the cultural linkages at a regional level, but I think there's a natural affinity with that and they feel more comfortable doing things that way. As long as everyone gets an opportunity to have representation and to be listened to and have processes whereby they can determine priorities based on what the communities really want.
Last time we spoke to you, you were continuing to develop a partnership between the federal government and the country's peak Indigenous community-controlled organisations. You have continued to advocate for greater partnership in that area. How's it progressing?
Yes, well, it's progressing very well, Larissa, I'm very pleased to say. So the partnership agreement with the Coalition of Peaks and all the Australian governments was signed, came into effect in March, so it's only 4 months after the decision was made at COAG to enter into a partnership with us as representatives of our constituencies, the peak Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community-controlled organisations. So we now have a membership of around 50 organisations at both the national level and the state and territory level that are involved in the Coalition of Peaks. We've just completed a survey where we went out and asked anybody to give us feedback. 70% of the respondents were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander individuals or organisations, and astounding, astounding level of participation with over 1,660 responses to the survey. It was a little complex, but we'll learn from that and make it more streamlined in the future. We also conducted over 50 face-to-face engagements with our people across the country. And this has all been done within the space of a couple of months, Larissa. So we're busy compiling the results of the survey and the feedback from those engagements. When we did the engagements at the community level, the state and territory governments in the main funded our community-controlled organisations and worked with us to convene those meetings and assisted with all of the arrangements and the notes. So it's been a really very successful, productive partnership. And whatever new arrangement the federal government comes to as a result of the voice is at the regional and national level to the federal government must take account of what's happening within state and territory governments, and they should be very closely negotiated with.
as a result of now having put these things in place and that enormous amount of work that you've just described that you've been doing, what's your hope now in terms of how that Close the Gap agenda might be rolled out?
Yeah, so we had the partnership agreement signed. That's a very high-level overarching document. But we undertook the engagements and the survey to get widespread input into the new national agreement on closing the gap that all governments will sign up to with us. So we consulted on our reform priorities and we've had extraordinarily strong support for those. We compile that, we'll get it ready. We've got a partnership working group between the Coalition of Peaks and the senior officials on the 22nd of November. And we will have a meeting where the Coalition of Peaks reps meets with the ministers and the president of the Local Government Association and Ken Wyatt, the federal minister for Indigenous Affairs, and I co-chair the Joint Council. So we'll go to Joint Council early next year with the draft national agreement and hopefully they will endorse it and then we can put it to the First Minister's meeting of COAG, the Prime Minister, the Premiers and the Chief Ministers and the President of the Local Government Association and hopefully they will sign that off with us and we'll have a new agreement that will last over the next 10 years and it will include all of the work that needs to be done by all of us to get a very marked improvement in the quality of life for our people across the country.
Obviously, one issue that has been on everyone's radar this year and progressed by many states has been the issue of a treaty. You travel around the country, you'd be seeing those different processes. What's your thought on that? And what does that mean at the federal level?
Yes, well, very interesting and a fantastic initiative, of course, on the part of Victoria and now Queensland and the Northern Territory. I think that it'd be fair to say the federal government would like that state level and territory level treaty process to be done throughout the country and see what's left for them. But one of the important factors with the state level treaties is that the states administer the land. And at the heart of our raison d'etre as First Nations people is our land, as is our culture, is our everything. It's very important that these land processes are fully dealt with, I reckon, at the state level, but not to usurp the national legislation on native title or on the Northern Territory Land Rights Act, which we will always want under Commonwealth control. But then you have got some remarkable arrangements under states' land rights with the APY lands in the northwest of South Australia and others and the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act. So some of these other states have really got to get on with it. But I think the Commonwealth's probably saying, phew, and breathing a sigh of relief that the states have started. But I still think it's a good initiative and I think it'll put more pressure on the federal government to look at the unique status of First Nations people, even once the state and territory level treaties are enacted, the Commonwealth has to start thinking about where does it fit and what is it going to do for a lasting final sort of acknowledgement and recognition of us taking our rightful place in our own country. And I think there's a lot more for the Commonwealth to do. But at the moment, they're probably thanking their lucky stars the states have started.
Well, as I said earlier, it's a bit of a tradition to get your snapshot of the year in review. And it is a tradition to ask you to give a bit of a report card to both sides of Parliament on how they've gone during the year. So can we start with what sort of a report card you would give the Scott Morrison government?
Look, I think in terms of a scorecard, okay. A historic appointment of Ken Wyatt as the first Aboriginal person to a cabinet post, which is what we've always called for. And I think there's a very strong obligation on the part of the Liberal Party and the Nationals to back Ken all the way and not just throw him into the frying pan and leave him to burn alone, which a lot of people suspect. my call is for the government to back Ken all the way and enable him to do the best possible job. He represents us in the cabinet, and to enable him to do that, he's got to have the confidence of all of his party. I want to see what this next budget contains, because we're still waiting for the $500 million to be reimbursed that Hockey and Abbott ripped off us a few years ago. And the Prime Minister has put a high priority on youth suicide, and especially in Aboriginal communities. So we want to see that reflected in the budget figures, with that money going directly to Aboriginal community-controlled initiatives to address suicide and mental health initiatives, and not being channeled through every other organisation and its dog. And I think that the Prime Minister needs to understand that while there's been a huge focus on funding for women and domestic violence, that none of that mainstream money has hit our organisations to the extent that it should, and in response to the need. So we're trying to get governments across the board to understand that they need to change the way they work with our people, and they need to negotiate with our people, not just come out and say, well, have I got a program for you? Or to continue to fund non-Indigenous organisations to deliver services to us that we can do much better than anyone else.
What sort of report card would you give Anthony Albanese's opposition?
Well, I think the Labor Party has been in shell shock for too long, and I'm glad that Anthony Albanese is starting to chart a new pathway. And I'm glad that Linda Burney is our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs Shadow Minister. I think Linda's an extremely competent Member of Parliament, and we work extremely well with her. We really want cross-party support on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander matters. We're sick of being wedged, but the Labor Party has said that they will deliver on the Uluru Statement from the Heart and constitutional recognition and just get on with it. But it's easy to say when you're in opposition. So their true record will count when they actually deliver that. I've found the Shadow Minister, Chris Bowen, really good to work with. So I must go back to the Morrison government and the working relationship that I have in my day-to-day job as CEO of NACHO with Minister Hunt, who I find exceptionally supportive and excellent. So he last week attended the NACHO conference in Darwin. And for the first time in goodness knows how long, we're getting an additional $90 million given directly to our services at the local level, our Aboriginal medical services across the country, plus an additional $31 million in indexation. We've never had this before. We've argued long and hard for this money. And we're also working with the department on a needs-based funding formula, which will hopefully be finalised by mid-next year. So that money starts to flow to our organisations on the 1st of July, and it's the first major injection we've had for so long you wouldn't believe it. And that's because of our lobbying, but also Greg Hunt hearing our voices and responding appropriately. You know, he's willing to accord the absolute priority in Aboriginal health, and I'm very happy to work with him to make sure that those investments continue in the right areas. It's no money to be sneezed at. We're very grateful, and we will make the absolute best use of that additional funding.
It has been a very big year for you, Aunty Pat, probably not much different to any other year where it's frantic and frantic and you're involved in every major important thing, which is why we're so lucky to have you with us this evening. But from your personal point of view, what were your highs and lows of 2019?
Well, the highs have been the Sir Roland Wilson Foundation announced a new scholarship for Aboriginal public servants doing postgraduate studies. So five scholarships named after me, by the way, the Pat Turner Scholarship.
How fantastic.
Yeah, which was, I feel very humbled, but I'm very proud of that. So they're doing well. Another five have just been announced starting next year. So it's a rolling program for 5 years. So it's great. It's great. And all postgraduates with Charles Darwin and ANU in partnership. So that was a proud personal moment, I guess. And then just the work of NACHO and what we've been able to achieve has just been continuous improvement and engagement and very strong partnerships right across the board. I'm pleased with the way that we're progressing our planning on ending rheumatic heart disease, because 98% of Australians who suffer rheumatic heart disease are our people, and primarily in Northern Australia. And our mission in End Rheumatic Heart Disease Coalition is that no child born today will die of rheumatic heart disease. So we've got to get our endgame strategy funded, which is additional to the vaccine development and the research work. It's got nothing to do with research. This next stage is about putting resources at the community level, engaging with the community, and really getting a strong integrated arrangement to eradicate this very debilitating disease that affects primarily our children. So we have kids as young as 5 having open heart surgery, Larissa. It's just tragic and totally preventable. And if we, of course, over the next 5 to whatever years, develop the world's first vaccine to eradicate it, then we will contribute that to the world, which is a fantastic initiative. But we need to get this on-the-ground work to eradicate rheumatic heart disease funded, and we are producing the best evidence we can to the government to enable that to happen. So I'm very excited and buoyed by that, because I just want this disease eradicated. So there are a few of the highs, which is good that I've had some.
Just finally tonight, you've had such a big year, so many things to have really put your energy into. How are you spending Christmas and the new year? I hope you're taking a break.
Well, I'm taking about 2 weeks, because I want to get that new national agreement on closing the gap signed off by COAG. So we've got a bit of work to do in the new year. I am going to take a few days to go and have some massages and whatever between Christmas and New Year. And I'm really looking forward to that with my sister. Other than that, we're just going to stay at home and have a quiet Christmas and New Year, and then take off down to Kangaroo Valley for 4 days for the retreat, and then we'll decide whether we have a wild New Year or not.
Well, I'm sure either way, I'm glad that you're taking just a little break, because you're going to have to recharge those batteries. It sounds like in 2020 you'll be hitting the ground running.
Yeah.
Well, Aunty Pat, thank you so much. Obviously, just listening to you tonight gives us just a snapshot of how many things that you're taking leadership of across the community. So it's been such a privilege, as always, to have you here on Speaking Out this evening to share your experiences, your thoughts and your reflections.
Thank you very much, Larissa.
Aunty Pat Turner is the CEO of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation.